This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And we are indeed Brooke Spector, and this is The Deep Dive, and we're live to you today. We often pre-record because of guests' availabilities, and today we're live because of guests' availabilities. They work for a living, they do interesting artistic and creative things, but they actually have to do them. So we catch them early in the day, and I'm really, really pleased to have two guests on air with us. I mean, those of you who listen to us frequently know that we like to alternate between international politics and economics. And last week we did science, hard science. The week before that, we took a look at how polling is actually done and why it matters in elections. And today we have Kitty Petla and Elroy Phyllis Bell. Kitty is, you may not, listeners may know her name. She has been a stalwart of the dance community in this country, I guess since she was probably about 10. And most recently, she's been the highlight of a CNN infomercial describing not just her dance work as a dancer, but her work in bringing dance to a much wider recognition and understanding and appreciation and participation by people in places where dance, ballet especially, was not necessarily considered the most obvious and influential art form. But let me just briefly introduce her. She, for a long time, we got to know her when she was a star with Ballet Theatre Afrikaan, and Martin Schoenberg was the head of this. And Martin's now living in Israel, and we originally had hoped to have Martin on air today as well. That didn't quite work for his schedule, so we're going to try to catch up to him shortly. Martin's been a dear friend for many years, and if you look at Kitty's roster of characters that she, and roles that she has performed, it is a whole roster of all of the classics, from Giselle to the Corsair to Don Quixote to Cinderella, Coppelia, La Bayarde, the Nutcracker Reimagined, Carmen, Sleeping Beauty, and even crossover work like Big City, Big Dreams. And she's been in international ballet competitions and on and on. And as I said, you probably can still see her on CNN doing her thing. People seem to love that insert. And also with us, but we're going to speak mostly to Kitty at the beginning because of her time constraints. We also have with us Elroy Phyllis Bell, and we'll reintroduce him at the midpoint. He's now the CEO of the Joburg Ballet. We talked to him, about almost a year ago when he was about to become the CEO. And one of the things that we talked to him about was how to broaden out the kind of work that the Joburg Ballet routinely is offering. And I'm really, really pleased to see that the production that starts really soon, has work that is contemporary work by living choreographers, including one of South Africa's great favorites, Dada Masilo, another dear friend. And she's doing, or she has created a dance around the character of Salome. Salome is a sort of a curious character. She doesn't quite fit the traditional role, but we'll talk about that too. Anyway, Kitty, let's start with you, and we're really pleased. Excuse me, we're really pleased to have you on air with us. But let's go with the hard question right at the beginning. Does ballet actually have a future in South Africa? Is the market too small Do the dancers begin to vacate the country and go on to greener pastures? Does it have any relevance anymore?
It definitely does. I mean, it's the basis and the foundation of everything. You know, I definitely think that the glass is half full in terms of the recognition of the art form itself. You know, we've still got a long way to go. You know, because for me, when I started, I think it was very important to go away from the westernized culture and, you know, ballet to be for the people, for all of us, for the world, you know, to be a universal language, because that universal language, there's sub-languages that come out of that classical language, which is contemporary, neoclassical, and so forth, you know. So for me, there's definitely a glass that's half full. It's still very relevant, you know. But I think the question now is that how do we approach it and stay relevant to the young mind, you know, which is quite the challenge at the moment. But in terms of your question, definitely it's still very, very relevant, especially for me as a choreographer. If I need to work with certain dancers, I think it just makes it easier if you have that background. Yeah.
I'm waiting for some local choreographer with ballet moves to do something with Ama piano music, but maybe I'm just inspiring you to think about that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, this is what kids today find relevant, you know, but I feel like it's also interesting to understand the roots of everything before you can break the rules, you know, because the beauty of understanding a certain culture then allows you to understand how to break the rules and seek for that freedom within the realm itself, you know, because I feel like you can't just break out and not understanding where it all comes from, because that's very important.
Listeners, unfortunately, can't see Kitty, but as she's talking, her hands are dancing, and they are dancing in a very precise and structured way. They're not just sort of random arm waving. They are telling me a story. It's wonderful to watch. I feel privileged. And she just gave me the universal sign for love. That was so nice. Thank you.
Oh, gosh, that's funny. It's true. It is true, yeah.
The challenge that I see for ballet companies, and even in many ways contemporary dance companies, is building an audience of people who want to see this kind of work rather than their old favorite. I mean, you can run a ballet company in the world by just doing the Nutcracker 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year, I suspect. But it's probably harder to bring in other things and to make people show, make them come in, sit down, watch, and go, okay, I buy that. I believe it. I mean, I came to it differently. I loved modern dance and was sort of dragged into ballet by my wife. But I was unusual in that sense. I enjoyed the other version first. How do you bring people to work that's new, that's modern, that's disturbing even?
For me, I tend to not agree with that kind of notion. I always feel like ballet will always exist. And I feel like your audience can always be taught. You can always train your audience. Like, for instance, you know, coming back from the background of Ballet Theatre Africa, Martin's company, which I felt was so ahead of its time. You know, you have to start somewhere. There is always an audience. And that's why I think it's so amazing what Elway is doing, bringing back that whole culture of a triple bill, contemporaries, because there's always an audience, you know, because now, when you look at scarcity, it's got a bit of everything. There's neoclassical, there's contemporary, but yes, it is very contemporary based, but there's always an audience. You just have to train your audience. So for me, I don't feel that I can stick with, okay, the audience will always support ballet. So what are we saying about the companies that are doing all these triple bills, the likes of NDT, Scapino, you know, for instance, there's nothing wrong with doing an excerpt of Giselle and then doing a contemporary piece and doing a neoclassical piece, because I feel like audiences can be trained. Audiences are very, very smart. We need to open that dialogue with our audiences, because if you keep feeding them the same thing, they're going to have the same expectations. But now, if you open their minds, audiences are very, very smart. There's always a beautiful conversation that you can have with the audience. So for me, there's always an audience for a program such as Scarcity, you know, because I've been doing these kind of programs since I was a kid, you know, back then with Martin. So there's always, always an audience. We started from nowhere, and then eventually you train your audience that, okay, we give a bit of classical, we give a bit of contemporary, we give a bit of neoclassical, you know. So your great classics are still there for people who love their great classics. And those who have an open mind can venture into the contemporary, you know, and then those who still have a strict culture can then still venture into neoclassical. So you got to give an audience a bit of everything, you know. So that's why I say that culture is there. There is an audience for it.
Cindy, I have to interrupt, and we have to take a station break and a commercial break because we have to train our audience that way too. So we'll be right back after this message. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and our guests today are Kitty Petla and Elroy Phyllis Bell.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is Brooke Spector. Is back with The Deep Dive, and I'm really pleased with today's guests, Kitty Petla from the Johannesburg Ballet Theater, and Elroy Phyllis Bell, the CEO of that organization. And Kitty's done all kinds of things, and we have to talk to her first because she has to go off and rehearse or practice or train dancers to do something that they're not used to doing. So let's take a couple of more questions. Toward Kitty.
My apologies. That's an intercom announcement. I'll just mute.
Ah, okay. I couldn't figure out what that was. Your voice had changed. Okay. Let me change the direction slightly. We were talking about reaching audiences, and you've had years of working with communities. I don't like the phrase underserved. But it's true. They have been systematically underserved with this kind of work. And I know you've been teaching younger students, but you've also been a mentor to people. You've been an example. Is that a heavy burden? Is it like a rock on your shoulders, or is it like a very gentle cape that you have to put on?
I don't know. I always try to always be in pursuit of being the master of my craft. And I feel, you know, the relationship between mentor and mentee is one that's very, very, very interesting and peculiar, because I feel a mentor has to have a certain level of readiness mentally and otherwise to take on that responsibility. So, you know, I think it's very humbling if someone sees me as a mentor, because, you know, a mentee can't just go and say, listen, can you mentor me? You know, it just, personally, I feel like it doesn't work that way. When the mentor is ready to mentor someone, because you essentially have to be someone's second skin if you are a mentor, you know, and you have to reach a certain level of readiness to be a second skin to another person to pass on your teachings, because I feel like we know a lot about nothing, to be honest. So so I hope that, you know, I really do give off that energy to someone who feels that I'm a mentor to them. Am I ready to be a mentor? I don't know. You know, it's really interesting that one would see me as a mentor. Yes, I do have an academy. Sometimes I feel like I learn so much more from them. You know, so it's for me, I'm a student first always. So I'm still also understanding the relationship between mentor and mentee. It's a very interesting and peculiar one. Yeah.
I mean, even as a dancer or a lead dancer or a, you know, the star, you are still being coached and directed and choreographed by somebody else who is stepping back from you to watch what you're doing and to say, a little more on the right upper arm this way, spin faster, do this, do that. So you're still being guided, even if you've reached the level of being a mentor. What's your interaction with the choreographer who is guiding and directing you?
Oh, man, for me, that's it's a place of freedom when I'm there, you know, because like I said, I consider myself a student first. So I'm like a sponge. So for me, it's literally a comfort zone. It is challenging as well mentally and physically. But what remains true always when I step into the studio is respect. You know, so I have an ongoing respect for that relationship, for the persons in front of the room, whether they are older than me or younger than me. There's just always respect for the space, the work, and the person. So therefore, everything just happens organically and effortlessly because it's a place it's an altar, you know. So it's very sacred. So for me, that respect creates that sacred space for me. So it's such an effortless journey for me to be told what to do, or if I'm being coached. I really, really do respect that kind of relationship because I feel all from that. Yeah.
In the popular mythology, there's always this tension. If you watch films about ballet or ballet dancers, there's always some sort of deep emotional argument between dancer one and dancer two, or between the dancers and the choreographer, and somebody is always storming out of the room in fury and frustration. That doesn't seem to be you.
I think movies tend to portray a bit of a false perception of what truly goes on. I think being a performing artist in a wider perspective, I think, yes, we are professional athletes. I think one has to be loyal to the process, you know, and therefore you can't focus on all of that, because then when you allow your brain to focus on other things, then you lose out on what's really going on in front of you. So for me, I'm a true believer of true consciousness, be present in the now. So for me personally, I don't engage in that kind of stuff. So, but I've been so blessed to work with people that are so true to the work, like the likes of Joburg Ballet. There's such a loyalty to the work, and it's so sacred. So for me, that's what I'm saying. I think it's more of a movie-driven thing. I think in the real world, I think most dancers generally are very vain and insecure. So it's very important for them to always get things right and always practice and practice and practice, you know, keeping loyal to the work. Because at the end of the day, you have to showcase the work and the unity on stage. Yeah.
The film that, I don't know whether you ever saw the film, The Turning Point, with Anne Bancroft and Shirley MacLaine, which there is this rivalry that went back to, I guess, teenagerhood. And I must say, the dancers that I know or have known over the years never seem to have that kind of relationship. It always, as just as you say, it was always the work. Now, maybe it was, I wanted to be more in that work than somebody else, but it was always the work and not the me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The work always has to speak for itself. That's just the mantra, honestly. The work has to speak for itself, yeah.
I know you have to break off and go do dancerly things at 9:30, which it is now. And we look forward to seeing work that you're involved in coming up. But I thank you very much. And those listeners who don't know who I was talking to or didn't pay attention right at the beginning, Kitty Petla, dancer, teacher, inspirer, mentor, and currently appearing in a vignette, a sort of an infomercial on CNN, on the Africa Focus program. And it's such a wonderful insight into your world and your ideas and your thinking, as well as your actions and your activities. I'm pleased you could take the time. We hope really soon to have one of your early mentors on air as well, Martin Schoenberg, as I said, because the hope was we were going to pair you up and let you have just for old time's sake.
It would have been a really lovely surprise, but we still communicate. But more than anything, I just want to take the opportunity to say thank you to you for this opportunity. And man, a special thank you to Alroy. He's just so incredible. He's just such a great addition to Joburg Ballet. Man, I think he challenges everybody. And I just thank you so much for allowing me to be part of Scar City for the upcoming season. So I really, really appreciate it. My gratitude to you, Alroy. Thank you.
He's smiling. I can see him. He was smiling when you said that. Kitty, we'll let you go. Yeah. And then we'll see you soon. You take care.
Thank you.
And let's shift our attentions now to Alroy Phyllis Bell, who is now the CEO in it for real, as opposed to about to be at the Joburg Ballet. Just a couple of notes about him. He's had a varied and interesting arts management career, including the Javits Arts Center at the University of Pretoria, which if you haven't been there, you should go take a look at their collections and their works. And something I didn't realize until recently, that you had done some time with Arena Stage in Washington, which was one of my favorite theaters in the U.S., and they are one of the great regional theaters in America. You had other places with theater and with DALRO, the Dramatic Arts Literary, what's the R stand for again?
Rights Organization.
Rights Organization. Right. I should have written that part out. But now he's ensconced at the Joburg Theater. And one of the first works that you are doing there, you're not the artistic director, you're the CEO, artistic director to come. Is that right? We're still waiting on the final answer. But you've got a program of works, none of which are classics, all of which are created new for this. Well, not in one case, I guess it's already been created, but you've gotten the rights to do it. Craig Pedro's Ukanya Quenyanga, A Moonlight Waltz. Jorge Perez Martinez's Azul, set to Spanish guitar compositions. Chinese German choreographer Hannah Ma, The Void. Mm-hmm. And our own Dada Masilo with the work Salome, which probably ends rather violently, I would suspect, given Salome's life. One of the things that people often click their tongues about and were concerned about with the Joburg Ballet Theater was, yes, you did the classics and they were lovely and all that, but where was the modern work to push out those walls and challenge us? And here you have a whole session of these things coming at us all at once. Who made the decision to make this directional adjustment?
So I guess I have to take responsibility for that choice. I think with the company's obviously been going through quite a period of transition, and I came in, obviously we had a chat in June, and I feel like a completely different person to that individual that had that conversation before I stepped into this role. But it's been a period of very quick-footed learning and immersing myself into this discipline and this company. And part of that was really picking up where there was very little from an artistic plan perspective for this year coming in. We really had to restructure. We had one particular item, which is Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, that had been in development, which is premiering in October. And then we needed to think about what the rest of the season looks like. And I'm actually really proud. I was able to engage with some really great friends in the business, some colleagues both internationally and locally, to consult, and really had a good sort of sort of engagement with variety of people that I respect and value within the space to help guide us and help really push us in the right way as we program the full year. So we've got two very strong beloved classics in the year, and then we've also got a premiere, a world first, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory coming up. But this first season, Scarcity, was something. As an applied theatre background, you've mentioned the fact that I've got quite a varied experience coming into Joburg Ballet. My first thought was, this year is significant because this is the 30th year of democracy for the country. It's an election year. We, as an organization and as a ballet company, have a particular responsibility to play here because, A, we are majority funded by the city of Johannesburg. And as an organization that's fulfilling this role within the city of Johannesburg sort of arts organizations under the Joburg City Theatres, what responsibility do we have in this moment to reflect the current moment of our citizenry and understand what the experience is and provide either an outlet, a reflection, a mirror into those experiences? So we started kind of unpacking what this moment looks like. And I think the prevailing feeling is that it is a moment of scarcity. It is a moment where we feel that there's limited of most things, limited access, limited resources. And so we try to grapple with that and trying to understand, if we provided this conceptual sort of baseline to a variety of choreographers that we would love to work with and really want to experience their work for Johannesburg, but also as the country, what sort of responses would we get to this concept? And the responses have been exceptional. They've been so broad. They've been so engaging. From Ukukanya Kunyanga, from Craig Pedro, which is the classical ballet piece, it's really structured around hope, resilience, what you're able to create when you have very limited options or opportunities. The Void really speaks to human existence and the value of human existence in the context of scarcity and how within, as Hannah Mapp phrases it, in a world set on fire, how do we value the humanity? And then Azul by Jorge Perez Martinez, which is the only work that has been pre-existed and is now having its first premiere on the continent, really focuses on the notion of fluidity of water. It's very evocative of that water. And then we then speak about, then he engages because he's from Spain originally and who works in the Netherlands. His work is focused on the communities of the Mediterranean and how they build community and experience around bodies of water, around the coastal sea. And then finally, Salome by Dada Masilo is so high, supercharged. I mean, if you know the story of Salome, it's historical opera, and then Oscar Wilde's plays, it's really about Salome as a daughter of Heron and her sort of attraction to Jokanon. And it's rooted within the Christian story, but obviously is fictionalized through Oscar Wilde's telling. And that was important for Dada because she didn't want it to be misconstrued by the public through a Christian lens only. She wanted to really drill down into the characters and the plot line that Oscar had created, or say Oscar like he's a friend, but as Oscar Wilde had done.
Elroy, I have to take a break. We have to do the necessary with station IDs and advertisements and commercials to our sponsors.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is indeed The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest now is Elroy Phyllis Bell. Earlier, we had Kitty Petla, the dance institution now almost in this country. She's been and done all manner of things, and Elroy is now ensconced as the actual CEO of Johannesburg Ballet Theater, and he's busy in a gentle and pleasant way, apparently throwing all the cutlery every which way and changing the nature of what the company does. All right, you have the classics, but you've also got a program which starts shortly, really, with works by living choreographers, ending up with a South African work, which is on the gentle, calm, reassuring story of Salome.
It's quite exciting. I think it's so Scarcity opens on the 15th of March at Joburg Theatre. And I honestly,
Brooks, called Scarcity, yes.
Yeah, so that's the bull, because that's the concept that all the choreographers have responded to in many ways, I think. And it's also kind of played in the split between Scar and City as well, because we're also trying through the works. I mean, artistically, we're delving quite deep. And so we also understand what's left. What are the repercussions on our landscape in light of this scarcity? So I think there's layers of interpretation here. We've got some interesting moments. I think, particularly as we talk about Salome, I think Dada's created something extraordinary. We know Dada's style is very much about creating work as accessible as possible within the contemporary frame. So really often taking these operatic plot lines or these ballet plot lines that are very familiar, and then really engaging and contextualizing it within the South African and African body and within the South African and African landscape. So her Salome is very similar to that. It's very high-paced. It's textured from a choreographic perspective. The music is evocative, but also from a plotline perspective, it stays true to the story. And it does, it can be, I'm reluctant to say the word graphic, because it's still appropriate for all people. It would be recommended. Yeah, it's just very vivid. I mean, I must say up ahead to anyone listening that there are lifelike casts, head casts of individuals' heads. For obviously the ending of Salome, there's no spoilers here. If you haven't engaged with a 19th century story, that's not my fault. But at the end, Jokanaan's head gets ripped off as part of what Salome asks of the king. And so we've cast lifelike heads of the dancers that are playing him throughout the season. So it looks very lifelike. There's no blood splattering, so to speak, but there is a really lifelike head that looks like the head of the dancer playing the character. So I suppose that's a little bit of a warning that needs to be given ahead. But what we've been saying is she stays true to the story. So I think that's what's clear here.
Let me go back to a question really that I had earlier asked Kitty, which was the whole nature of ballet in the modern world, the modern universe, especially South Africa, which has all manner of demands and needs on government and institutions. When I first read the title of the collective show, I wavered back and forth between Scarcity and Scare City in my mind. I don't know why I did that, but that's another layer you can think about. But the question though really is this art form still appropriate, useful, and meaningful even for people now, when so many other things are crying out for attention?
I think we get into dangerous territory when we're trying to ask that question without the context of the role of the arts. I mean, if you look at even throughout the struggle of South Africa, using art as a weapon, as Albie Sachs it says, like, there's such an important role for the arts to play. And I think particularly ballet within this current moment, and particularly the way we're re-engaging with the notion of ballet. I think it's important for us as arts practitioners and cultural institutes to really provide some sort of discourse, whether that be ephemeral or really just experiential and entertainment. But there's also a moment for us to really engage in the social environment and the social context that we are operating in. I think we have a responsibility to do that as artists. And I think there's no better form for that discourse to be stimulated than through an artistic form such as ballet and dance. So I think there might be a misconception previously around And I suppose that's also framed by how this kind of particular organization had been operating, is why am I watching the ballet? What is it serving me? And how am I engaging this within the broader context of my life? And I think that's really up to the audience member. I think we see about how we're trying to engage with audiences to experience this new thing that they don't know, because it's easy to sell tickets to the Nutcracker. You mentioned it earlier, about 11,000 people saw our Nutcracker in Joburg, another 4,000 saw it in Durban. I think it's very easy for people to engage with classics they know, but then how do they engage with something that is new, that they're not familiar with? Because at the end of the day, it's dance. You kind of need a little bit of an in sometimes if you're not familiar with the art form. And so we've been really conscious about how are we marketing this work? How are we engaging with our audiences? How are we broadening and diversifying that audience? And so we've been implementing some different methodologies along the way. We have an audience engagement strategist coming in to build a more broader audience engagement strategy for us. We're going to do focus groups for this work. So it's very interesting to see that feedback on online as well, as we share behind the scenes rehearsal footage for people to see what the work looks like. It's really stimulating a lot of engagement. And for us, what we now need to see is a translation of that engagement online into people actually buying tickets.
We're going to take a station break real quickly, and we'll be right back, continuing and finishing our conversations with Elroy Phyllis Bell of the Johannesburg Ballet Theater. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. We'll be back in a minute.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back, I believe. Yes, we are. I am Brooke Spector. It is The Deep Dive, and we're finishing our conversation with Elroy Phyllis Bell, the CEO of the Joburg Ballet. We were talking before the commercial break about accessibility and understanding and appreciation for what is seemingly an alien landscape. One of the things that I have learned over the years, especially when I was working with arts groups internationally in various countries, was that in many ways, dance was one of the easiest ways to connect to audiences who did not even share the same language or culture, because everybody moves, everybody has an action, and the story is either presented or the plot, if there is one, is presented through the movement, almost separate and apart from any notes that you might be handed in your program, because you have to see it to appreciate it. And what that leads me, though, to the question of how adventurous do you plan to be now, not just with the work, but with site-specific work, taking the program to places which are not the usual stage for a dance work, whether it's a river basin or a mountainside or a coal mine or whatever, you know what I mean.
I hear you, Brooks. I have to be careful here, because you also know I previously worked with Jay Pather's company, Soela Sonke, which was also very site-specific leaning. But ballet is a very different form. I think ballet requires a particular environment so that your points don't get damaged, so that the floor is slightly sprung, so that when you're landing, you're not impacting your joints too much. So these are things that we have to consider when we're thinking about what work we take to which areas. So as an example, we are taking Scarcity to the Kaka in Kaa in the last week of March for the first time, really. I think it's the first time we've had dance on the Kaka in Kaa in a while, and particularly classical sort of leaning dance. And as a result of that, we aren't able to take the classical ballet piece, Craig's Ukukanya Kanyanga, to that theater because the floor's not sprung enough. But the neoclassical works, the contemporary works that are forming part of that, that are very classically rooted in the technique, are going to the Kaka in Kaa, the Klein Karoo Nationale Kunstefeest in Oudtshoorn as well. And this work is also going to the Baxter in October. So we are thinking about in what ways we're touring more in the country, we're really traveling around, but now we're also thinking about in what spaces can we create moments for audiences to engage. So does that, we start looking at in for example, that walking around can suddenly engage for the first time in something they've never experienced before, and watch a snippet of a ballet piece and think to myself, oh, I'd really love to see the Sleeping Beauty in June. Or we have our fundraiser is taking place at Beechwood Gardens, actually, this year for Mother's Day. So we're actually creating something small to be performed in that garden. So it is something we're thinking about, but it is something that we have to be very careful and conscious of because of the discipline we're in.
Oh, you know, the vicissitudes of the sprung floor are well known to me. You really don't want dancers to show up and say, I broke my ankle, thanks to you.
That'd be
a crisis for you. Let me, with the time remaining, we just have a couple of minutes left. Why don't you give the audience an opportunity, tell them how to get tickets and when, and, you know, the usual stuff. You have to let them know.
Fantastic. Thank you, Brooks. So Scarcity is at the Joburg Theatre. It opens from the 15th of March and runs to the 24th of March. We have 9 performances. We've got 7 p.m. on Fridays, 2 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. And then we have a Wednesday and Thursday at 11 a.m. So we've been very thoughtful around access and creating moments where people can actually afford tickets as well. So on our opening night, we have half price tickets. The tickets are as cheap as 110 Rand to come in and watch the opening night. Our morning shows on the Wednesday and the Thursday, the 21st, which is also Human Rights Day. So there's no excuse to come in the morning. It is 100 Rand, 110 Rand to come in for all tickets for those two morning shows. And then the rest of the tickets are ranging between 220 to 450 Rand, depending on where you're sitting in the theater. So that's our Joburg Theater run. Then we're going to the Kaka and Ka in Oudtshoorn on, I believe, the 27th and the 28th are our two performances. We're excited about that. All bookings are through web tickets for both runs. So just look up Joburg Ballet, Scarcity, and you'd be able to find tickets there. This particular show is also going to the Baxter in October. So that's also something for Cape Townians to look out for.
That is good. That gets you out around the country to audiences that haven't seen the Joburg Ballet for a long time, if ever. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you and to speak earlier with Kitty. I'm delighted we could do you both on one show. And I wish you all the success with Scarcity. This is Brooke Spector, The Deep Dive. We'll be back again next week around 9 o'clock with yet another conversation in the arts or in science or in international politics or diplomacy or international economics. And I'm not sure what we'll do next week, but we'll keep it varied. Anyway, we've got to go. We got to make space for the next program. It's been a pleasure to bring you this version of The Deep Dive. Until next week, take care.